Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going a little east, as an Asian, presenting to you Chinese, Korean, and then Japanese.
But not in ways that you would find very, well, in unexpected ways. Because although we've identified the show will include things about Chinese, things about Japanese, and things about Korean. All the people we talk to are here in the good old United States. And starting out with...
Our favorite baker, and just general interviewer. I mean, she's just so intelligent and so good to talk to, Joanne Chang, that I always welcome her interviews.
Yeah, from Flower Bakery in Boston, and... a retired mathematician turned wonderful baker and pastry chef.
Yeah, this is a great concept, too. It's called baking with less sugar. I always look forward to a new book from Joanne Chang of Flower Bakery and Cafe. It's, as I said to you beforehand, I know that you were so interested to talk to because you're so intelligent. And your books are also intelligent, so I know I'm going to have a good interview. Your latest book is, it was sort of unexpected because you have a lifetime exposure to sugar, but this is called Baking with Less Sugar, Recipes for Desserts Using Natural Sweeteners and Little to No White Sugar. Well, that's quite a statement coming from a bakery person.
Coming from somebody who sells sweets and sell sugar for a living, I agree. That is quite a statement. But what I hope comes through in the book is that I'm not trying to badmouth sugar at all, but rather what I'm hoping to do is introduce people to the idea that you can actually create more flavor in your baking and in your desserts if you don't rely solely on white sugar to sweeten your desserts. And I think that's an area in which some of us have gone a little too awry, where we tend to overload our desserts with a lot of sugar because people like sweet things. And so we think a little bit of sweet is good, a lot of sweet is better. And I think that that's not necessarily the case. I think a little bit of sweet is good, and then keeping it at a little bit of sweet and making it more flavor is better. So I've reduced the sugar in a bunch of recipes and come up with recipes that have a lot more flavor.
Now, white sugar is an improvement on high fructose corn syrup, though, right?
It is, and so I don't eliminate it entirely from the book. In fact, the entire first chapter includes recipes that are made simply with less white sugar, not no white sugar. But then the following chapters have recipes that are sweetened solely with honey, for example, or maple syrup, or molasses. Or there's even an entire chapter of desserts sweetened with fruits and fruit juices. So there's a number of different ways to sweeten desserts without white sugar.
And you've organized your book along the lines of what you just told us about. When you take sugar out, you have to put something in. And these are the things you put in.
Yeah, I tried to find things that would be really readily accessible to anybody. In fact, I didn't, you know, there's a lot of different sweeteners out there. There's a lot of different artificial substitutes, there's natural substitutes, and I definitely didn't want to do artificial sweeteners, but I toyed around with the idea of baking with maybe stevia.
Oh yeah, now that, by the way, is, I think your little notes on agave and stevia,
yeah.
they really, I believe in what you just, or you're telling us about it, is that the agave is a pretty dangerous plant, in the kind of sugar processing of it ends up giving you the same mess as high fructose corn syrup.
Exactly. And I didn't, you know, I'm not a scientist or a food nutritionist or anything, and so I didn't want to spend a lot of time trying to research whether or not those claims are really true or not true. So what I did was I just focused on the sweeteners that we all know and love and are very, very familiar with, that nobody is going to look at and say, I don't trust that. So there's honey, there's maple syrup, there's fruit juices. I mean, apple juice, orange juice, grape juice, dates, all things that we have all grown up with, that we are all very comfortable consuming. And if you can use those flavors to sweeten your desserts, then why not?
you were not a scientist, but you are a mathematician. Isn't that what you really are?
Yes. Well, at this point, I feel like I'm a little bit of a chemist, too, because baking has so much chemistry. Yeah.
Well, that's what I was leading up to, is this chapter, what I thought was fascinating, called What's Behind the Science of Sweets. I had no idea that sugar played all these different roles in baking.
And you know what? I didn't either. I thought, okay, if I reduce the sugar in baking, then all I'm really going to have to do is figure out how to make something taste sweet that doesn't have a lot of sugar. I really thought that was going to be the big challenge. I thought I was going to have to look into different spices, maybe some extracts, maybe some different types of nuts or flours that are more naturally sweet. But it turns out trying to adjust your palate to the different levels of sweetness, that's super easy to do. The challenge with baking with less sugar is the chemistry of baking, which relies on sugar for moisture. It relies on sugar for texture, for keeping qualities.
How about browning? I thought that was amazing. So
yeah,
these recipes are going to be paler, actually.
Yes, exactly. And if you look at there's a picture of a vanilla pecan coffee cake, streusel coffee cake, that is absolutely delicious. It's made with a tiny amount of sugar, a little bit of honey, but a lot of nuts, a lot of cinnamon, and it just tastes really great. It's got a lot of butter and creme fraiche, so you have a lot of really great flavors, but you don't have a lot of sugar, and the result is that it visually doesn't look like a coffee cake that you're used to seeing. It's very pale in color. It's a very pale yellow. And that can be tricky when you're baking, because a lot of us will bake by color. We'll look at it and say, oh, it's brown, now it's ready to come out of the oven. This cake, if you wait for it to be brown, it'll be burnt. So you need to touch the cake, and that's when you know it's finished, is when after you touch it, it's firm to the touch. But you can't tell from eating it that it has less sugar. It's just the visual appearance.
It's true, then, probably, of your pecan date shortbread cookies, which sound absolutely heavenly, by the way.
Yes, those too. If you're not careful, you will end up baking them longer than you should because you're waiting for them to get kind of golden brown. I mean, these are a little bit darker in color naturally because of the pecans themselves, which are brown, and the dates themselves, which are also brown. Mm-hmm. But keeping them kind of pale in color is going to be something that you just can't get them darker until you've overbaked them, because they don't actually have sugar. But this is one of my favorite recipes in the book because there's no white sugar. It's just dates, pecans, butter, some flour, some vanilla. I mean, the taste is incredible because you really taste the pecans and you really taste some sweetness, but it's like this rich, deep flavor of the nuts and the dates that sweeten the shortbread, and it's delicious.
Send me those, Joanne. They sound really good. You know, I have to call attention to something. You're a perfectionist, which I suppose goes along with, I mean, most baking people are precise.
Yes, but absolutely.
But you, coming from your mathematical background and your interest in science, do you put this little card in all the copies of the book?
Okay, so there is a card in all of the current copies of the book that's a note from me that is specifying a little bit in more detail any recipe that is made with dates. So there's probably about 6 or 7 recipes that use dates to sweeten the dessert. And unfortunately what happened is in kind of the editing and re-editing, an essential part of the measurement got omitted. And so in the book, it will list, for example, it'll say use 6 to 8 dates, but it doesn't tell you how much they weigh, and it doesn't tell you the volume of what that is. And dates can be small and large and medium. And so when I realized that that had been inadvertently omitted, I asked that we have a card inserted, and it's also on our website, so that if anybody is looking at a recipe that's made with dates and they're not really sure, you know, if they buy 6 or 8 dates, it might not be enough. And so I'm hoping that people will see the card and then make sure that they measure so they have enough dates.
Now, since you just mentioned it, let's make sure listeners know what that website is.
Oh, absolutely. So our website is www.flourbakery.com. That's F-L-O-U-R. So F-L-O-U-R-B-A-K-E-R-Y.com. And on the website, there's a link to the cookbook page, which lists any corrections that need to be made in the book. There's also a couple recipes and places that you can purchase the book.
Now, you have some really interesting things to say about chocolate. Tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, the quality of chocolate is really important, and I never actually thought what I prefer, as you know, I have no sweet tooth, so I prefer really high percentage chocolate.
Right.
Yeah, and I didn't even equate that with the part of it that has sugar in the processing of the chocolate. But
I too prefer the higher percentage chocolate, which means that it's simply got less sugar in it. So the higher the percentage of chocolate, the more cacao, which is the flavor of the chocolate. And then if you have more chocolate, then you have less sugar. But all bittersweet and semi-sweet chocolate has a little bit of sugar in it in order to make it a little bit sweet. And so using chocolate as the sole sweetener for desserts is something that came to me when I was writing this book, because I've made chocolate desserts all my life, and I use chocolate, and then I add sugar to whatever it is I'm making, whether it's a cake or a cookie or a pie. And I wanted to see if I could create desserts that just relied on the chocolate itself as the sweetener. And sure enough, there's a number of different things you can do where you can make a great chocolate dessert that is just sweetened with the chocolate with no additional sugar.
You're a genius.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. How about this pie crust with no sugar?
Yes, so we have a flaky pie crust that doesn't rely on any sugar whatsoever. It's really flaky, it's really light, and obviously it doesn't taste sweet at all because there's no sugar in it, but we make sure to pair it with either, in the chocolate chapter, there's a chocolate truffle tart, and so it gets sweetness from the chocolate truffle filling and the chocolate cream filling. We also use it to make a blueberry nectarine pie, and that's a recipe that really relies on the natural sweetness of the fruit. You have to get really ripe nectarines.
Yes, I was
really
going to say,
blueberries.
Yeah, I thought reading about your use of the fruit, some of the fruit that we get in, forget supermarkets, I mean, even, you know, like specialty markets, I mean, the fruit's just not as sweet as it used to be.
Yeah, I think a lot of times the markets, they are putting fruit on the shelves that looks good, but it doesn't taste good.
No taste at all, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything that you're going to cook with or bake with. If it doesn't taste good raw, it's not going to taste good once you cook with it or bake with it. So, you know, that's why we were just talking about high quality chocolate, using a great chocolate that you love to eat, making sure that if you're baking with fruit that you want to eat that fruit raw before you add it to a pie or a cake or anything like that. That's definitely, it's one of those tricks of professional cooking that doesn't feel like a trick, because I just feel like it's natural common sense. But if you don't bake or cook a lot, you might not think about that.
Well, I think, as I said, you don't have to sell me on this. I agree with you 100% on it. How about you with your sweet tooth, Rabbit?
What's that?
Do you agree you could have less sweets?
Oh, absolutely, yes. In fact, I was always considered very peculiar in my family growing up in England, because everybody in England loves milk chocolate.
In America too.
I didn't like it at all.
I
like the dark chocolate, what was actually called, since Cadbury's was the main brand, and Bourneville is the place where they had their factory. That's what they called their dark chocolate, and that was always what I went after. I couldn't understand why people wanted to eat this sort of milky stuff.
Right. I agree.
Well, see, I won't eat white chocolate, and I fall into that category you refer to as a chocolate snob. Saying that white chocolate is not chocolate, because it isn't.
Yeah, because we just got a couple of chocolate bars from our good friend Sean Eskenazi.
Oh yeah, right.
So I noticed. How many chocolate bars did we get?
No, we only got one
chocolate
bar. Oh,
you only got
bar,
one. I thought you
we
might.
We got the his hazelnut chocolate spread.
No, I thought you might have eaten one already.
No.
Oh, he has great chocolate. I love his chocolate.
See you like in your bakery, you use a Cho chocolate.
Which
is also great.
Using them for, I want to say, 4 or 5 years at least, and it's wonderful.
And they're interesting
Absolutely.
People. So is Sean Eskenazi.
Yeah.
I mean, they do good. They're on the right side of fair trade. I mean, everything's just perfect with their businesses.
Right.
One more thing before we wrap this up is I didn't want to ignore the role that sugar plays in frozen desserts. and ice cream.
Yes. So sugar, actually, what it does is it lowers the freezing temperature. So it makes it essentially, if you add sugar to something, it won't freeze hard. You have to put it into a much colder environment in order for it to freeze really, really hard. So if you're making ice cream, which always has sugar in it, and you put that in the freezer, it means you have something that won't ever freeze hard, which is what you want in an ice cream or sorbet. You want something that's a little bit soft so you can scoop it. So if you're trying to make a sorbet or ice cream with no sugar, then you really have to figure out another way to soften the ice cream, because otherwise when you freeze it, it freezes rock hard like a cube of ice, like a big ice cube. So there's a couple of different tricks that you can use, and one of the things that I utilize in the book is alcohol. Alcohol actually acts in the same way that sugar does. And so if you add a little bit of alcohol to an ice cream or a sorbet base, it will cause the freezing temperature to decrease so that you can actually put it in a freezer and it'll stay soft.
Amazing. Well, I certainly learned a lot with this book. Again, listeners, it's Joanne Chang has done it again. Baking with Less Sugar is the title of the book. And I think, considering what everybody's saying about our health in this country, this is really going to contribute a lot to straightening out some of our issues with desserts, I think.
I hope so, definitely.
Yeah, and you can eat dessert and not be deprived. It can taste splendid, and you're not going on some sort of uncontrolled sugar high.
Exactly.
Good. Well, good luck to you with the book.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Jillian, for taking time to talk to us.
Oh, my pleasure. Always great to talk to you guys.
Okay. Ciao, ciao.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after this short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, we have Nicole Provenzolo, who, it doesn't sound like a very Japanese name, but she wrote a book called Kyoto Fu, which opened for me, and probably will for you, a whole new world of uniquely delicious Japanese desserts. You have a unique concept, Nicole. Nicole Bermasolo, is that correct?
Close enough, Anne. Close enough.
you do it.
Berman Solo.
Well, that's what I thought I was saying, but I guess not. When I saw this book, it's Kyoto Fu, Uniquely Delicious Japanese Desserts, I realized I never even recognized or thought of the Japanese as making desserts, and you point out that I was totally wrong, that they make wonderful desserts. Tell us about that.
I'm sorry to say you are totally wrong. The Japanese love their sweets, and they make marvelous desserts, both kind of Western European-style desserts and traditional Japanese-style desserts. But I think kind of an overriding theme throughout all of their sweets making is an emphasis on seasonal ingredients, and also a reduction in sweetness versus what we're used to here in the U.S.
You know, we just interviewed Joanne Chang, who has, her book is Baking with
Less Sugar.
Less Sugar. So there's that concept too. I think everybody's getting to that point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know, we've seen the trend over the last 5 to 10 years of people not wanting such sweet desserts and not wanting big globs of icing on every dessert they have, and trying to focus more on the flavors and the more healthy aspects of desserts.
Yeah, well, this is fine with me because I don't have a sweet tooth, so I really welcome this. Tell us, well, there's so much I want to ask you. Let's start with, I was interested in your email address, and it's probably your website too, Hana Kitchens. Could you tell us about that concept?
Yes. So Hana Kitchens is kind of the sister concept to Kyotofu. It's the name of our kitchens, of which we currently have two. There's one in Brooklyn, New York, and another one in Huntington Beach, California. We're also opening two more this year, one in downtown Los Angeles and one in Toronto, Canada. And the concept behind Hana Kitchens is it's an incubator kitchen. So myself, my business partner, all of our staff with all of years of experience in all different areas of the food business, we've kind of gotten together and put together kind of like a 360-degree program where you could come into our kitchen. We provide equipment, we provide kitchen time, and then we also provide what we call incubation. So if you need help with recipe formulation, shelf life testing, packaging, logistics, distribution, we kind of provide guidance on all of that to kind of nurture new or growing, because it's possible that a small food business has reached a point where they're growing. We provide that kind of guidance, and that's been super rewarding part of the business and a part of the business that I really love.
Yeah, well, this is becoming more generalized in terms of savory as well as bakery, I mean, with these shared kitchens and startup enterprises.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And I think what sets us apart from other shared kitchens is that we actually provide some guidance on all of those things I listed, just based upon experiences that we have. When people come into the kitchen, I often tell them, if there's something I can help you with or give you guidance on to prevent you from making some of the same mistakes that I did, then that's great. Then that's a win.
So now your main business is...
Hold on a minute. But in these kitchens, you also make a little money making desserts.
Of course.
Well, I was just going to say her primary business, let's clarify that, is a Kyotofu bakery.
Exactly. So what will typically happen is we'll occupy a portion of the kitchen for making our desserts, and then the other portion of the kitchen will kind of be segmented off into individual kitchens that we call our incubator.
Now, how do your products reach the market? Do you have retail bakeries, or do you sell to restaurants?
We do not have retail bakeries. Our main client is Whole Foods, and then we also sell to different airlines. We've sold to Costco from time to time, some hotels, universities. So that's kind of our reach.
Nicole, Bermensolo is not Japanese.
It is not Japanese.
So I am,
if you could see me, Anne, you would see I look very Italian. I'm definitely not Japanese.
Well, no, the solo cup part could be just about anything.
Well, but tell us then, you need to explain how you fell in love with Japanese food and desserts in particular.
Yeah, I actually went over to Japan on a Japanese government scholarship to study business. And I did that for a couple of years, and studying business was great, but the main thing that stood out to me in Japan was the cuisine. I still believe it's like nothing else in the world. Just the kind of, if you guys have ever seen the movie Jiro, Dreams of Sushi,
yes.
I mean, there are tons of Jiros all over Japan that are just trying to perfect their craft, and they pass down knowledge through the generations. And so it was not only this pursuit of perfection in Japanese cuisine, but also just the amazing knowledge that gets passed down to generations, and these family businesses that have literally been making the same product for hundreds of years. It just really impressed me, really inspired me.
Well, desserts in your book are just beautiful. The Japanese are known for their packaging too, and their presentation, and it really shines in the desserts over here in this book.
Thank you.
It's sort of 180 degrees away from the concept of British desserts, where one of the most famous ones is called the Eton Mess. and it does look exactly like that.
Yeah, and also the British are famous for having the sweetest tooth on earth.
No. Well, just in case you're wondering what the Eton Mess is, it's a mashup of fruit and meringue, basically.
That sounds good. That sounds very good.
But it looks totally hideous.
Oh, you'd never find that in Japan. Everything looks beautiful because, again, you eat with your eyes first.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of these, like this black sesame rare cheesecake.
Mm-hmm.
It's gorgeous.
Thank you. And it tastes good, too.
Yeah, we could get back to that. I mean, you sort of take everybody in hand, because I imagine this is kind of a new area of exploration for many Westerners. But you walk us through, like, the typical stocking a typical Japanese pantry. And that's how you organize this book?
Yes.
According to ingredients?
Correct.
So
And the recipes themselves are not super complicated. They're meant to be able to be executed by a home cook. So it's kind of familiar procedures and techniques with maybe some unfamiliar ingredients.
Well, now, at first when I thought about this book, I thought that what you were doing was you were taking Western desserts and using Japanese ingredients in them. But that's not right.
At this point in time, something like, let's take a cheesecake, for instance, that you mentioned. Cheesecake is such a part of the Japanese dessert repertoire that I'm not even sure you could necessarily call it an American dessert. I don't think the Japanese think of it that way. So I think rather than thinking the book is fitting Japanese ingredients to American desserts, I think of it more as just embracing what the Japanese have done with desserts and made their own, you know, because that's what the Japanese do, especially in cuisine. They kind of take a cuisine and they make it their own throughout the decades.
I do want to challenge you on one thing about your approach. And Anne's grabbing the book here, but I'm trying to get the book here because I want to remind myself what the cover looks like. And you're saying that if I read your book and follow your instructions, I'll be able to make a dessert that looks just like that?
Peter, you will be able to, I promise. You will be able to.
Oh, I don't know about that.
This is not meant to just be a coffee table book. This is meant to be a book that someone with limited cooking or pastry experience could pick up and say, I want to try to make that, and it would work in the home kitchen.
Let me tell you a little story for just a second, and Emily will relate to this one. We met a Spanish chef who was one of the four women in the whole of Europe who had three Michelin stars.
Okay.
And she had some Japanese visitors who came regularly to her restaurant just outside Barcelona. And finally they said to her one day, they said, would you come and open a restaurant in Japan?
In Tokyo, specifically, a piece of art. And wanted her to, inspired by this work of art. And so she then opened, she has her restaurant, which is outside of Barcelona, her Tokyo restaurant, and then she has one that her son runs in Barcelona,
Barcelona
now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she is also, she's not just a chef, she is a trained artist. So this is a perfect opportunity to cross-reference her skills.
Absolutely. And I'm sure the Japanese truly appreciate the art that's present in her food.
Well, the interesting thing is that the dessert menu is pictures. His drawings of the different desserts, so that they don't have names. You just presumably, you point to the one you want.
I mean,
we just ate the one she served to us meekly, having had a wonderful meal all together.
I would love to visit that restaurant. Do you guys know the name?
Yes, sure. Yes, it's called Restaurant San Pau, P-A-U, and it's in St. Paul, P-O-L, de Mar, M-A-R, and the name of the owner is Carme.
C-A-R-M-E.
Yeah, with Carmen without the N on the end.
Right.
Ruscalleda.
Yeah, Ruscalleda. R-U-S-C-E-L-L-A-D-A. Ruscalleda.
Yeah, and you can hear, if you go on our website under audio archives and just find on this page, do that Ruscalleda, and you can listen to, we've had two interviews, I think, recorded with her.
Yeah,
great! I sure am going to do that. You've piqued my interest.
Oh, she's wonderful.
If you have any trouble getting in touch, let us know. I'm sure we have an email address for her somewhere.
Oh, sure.
Oh, great, great. It helps to know people in high places.
I don't know about that.
You know, reading through this book I like the idea. I'm a green tea nut.
Oh.
And it seems to me the green tea and variations of green tea is one of the most important ingredients, and it's everywhere.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know where that comes from? Green tea, matcha in particular, which is powdered green tea, is a part of the tea ceremony. And sweets were always a part of the tea ceremony because if you've ever had just straight matcha whisked with hot water, it's very bitter. And so the sweets in the tea ceremony were meant to mitigate the bitterness of the matcha. And so sweets and matcha in Japan have kind of been intertwined for probably 1,000 years at this point. So it's no surprise that matcha is one of the most popular sweets ingredients in Japan.
Maybe the English copied afternoon tea after the Japanese.
I think maybe they did.
Yeah.
I think we always thought it was the other way around.
I don't think so. Now, did I read correctly, and now I can't find it in the book, that once you stopped eating Western desserts and you started eating less sugary Japanese desserts, you lost 80 pounds?
Yeah, I think it was kind of you know, a whole just taking a different approach to eating.
That's a lot of pounds.
It is. And I think the Japanese approach to eating is very balanced. It's very portion controlled and very much just having everything in moderation versus eliminating one particular food group. And I think in that case, I think it's easier to be satisfied with food when you have a little bit of rice, a little bit of meat, a little bit of vegetables, and at the end of the meal, a little bit of something sweet. It's much easier to be satisfied versus Americans are very big into eliminating whole food groups, and that totally goes against the Japanese kind of mindset about food.
Well, I mean, that's a dumb thing. I don't know why.
Yeah.
It's one of those magic bullet things that they dream about. The other thing is I came across something about it's not only healthy, but it gives you beautiful skin.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Japanese are known for having beautiful skin. They're also one of the longest living populations in the world. So there's something to be said for following their diet or their way of thinking about eating.
Now, there are some obvious examples, I think, of where you adapt typically Western desserts, such as the financier,
mm-hmm.
the brown rice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just that's one. And then there was another one I read, too. But, like, what are your favorite? Just point out a few of them, because our listeners like this.
It's like asking a mother to pick who their favorite child is.
But just by example, listeners love to have details of these dishes.
Well, one of my favorite items in the book is probably our miso brownie. And it's kind of interesting because we learned that sweet and salt go well together, right?
Yeah.
So why not chocolate and miso? And miso has this wonderful kind of buttery, rich dimension to it that you don't get with straight salt, which I think works really, really well with chocolate. And the miso brownie is most people's favorite item that we produce.
Uh-huh.
So that's probably one of my favorites. And then I'm a sucker for our classic, which is our sweet tofu. It's so simple and yet so beautiful in its simplicity. It's one of my favorites as well.
Well, these challenge in many ways your concept of dessert, but I think that your idea of balance is something that is finally catching on with us in the Western world. It's been
Absolutely.
Part of the culture of the Eastern world for years and centuries.
Absolutely.
So I think this will be a well-received book. At least I hope so.
I certainly hope so. It's definitely my baby. It's been my life's work for the last 10 years, and I certainly hope people embrace it.
Well, I wish you success with the book.
Thank you so much.
And I'd like to have some of these to eat right now.
Well, come on out to one of my kitchens, and I will treat you to a smorgasbord of Japanese desserts.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Well, thank you very much for talking to us, Nicole.
Thank you so much, Peter and Ann.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Here we are again with another revelation. We've discovered some nuances of Korean cooking, including essentials and ingredients and where to get them. I think that there's unquestionably a renewed zest for eating Korean cuisine that's going on. I think that's safe to say, Grace Park, isn't it?
Oh, yes, for sure.
Why do you think it is? I mean, is it generally spicy? I mean, I think I've had spicy food.
It's hard to say. I wouldn't say it's generally. We do have lots of spicy food, and I think a lot of Koreans and non-Koreans would characterize Korean food as spicy. However, we do have lots and lots of non-spicy foods. Well, I like to say, though, we have very good spicy food. And I think the reason why it's getting popular, I don't know, my theory is Asian cuisines that have been popular for a while, you know, like Japanese and Chinese. And I think people are looking for something new. And I think that's part of the reason. And I think also, like you were saying, like David Chang and Hoonhee Kim, these sort of celebrity chefs are really helping. And also, there's another theory that Korean government has been part of this. And I think the previous president's wife, her mission was to make Korean cuisine global. So they actually did spend a lot of money and resources to spread Korean cooking. So that could be part of it because, you know, for example, like I know they were doing like giving out Korean food in Times Square and things like that. And
they
sponsor some companies across U.S. and things like that. So that could be part of it. Also, I think the very unique characteristic of Korean food is actually fermented food is very key in Korean cooking.
Right.
And yeah, and I think fermented foods are kind of a fad these days, you know?
Well, I don't know about fad. They've been around for a long time. People are now interested
That's
in
true.
Making them and eating them because of their probiotic health.
Right, right, and yeah.
You asked me how I found you, and I don't remember.
We're glad we did, but we don't remember.
But it could be just because I was looking for somebody to explain the profile of Korean cooking to me, and also about the hot new ingredients that are Korean, although I can't pronounce them. And it turns out you have two internet businesses, one called CrazyKoreanCooking.com, and the other one called CrazyKoreanShopping.com. So on one, you talk about the cuisine and give recipes, and on the other, you supply authentic, I'm assuming, products.
Yes, yeah.
Now,
definitely, yeah. Our mandate is to spread authentic Korean cooking, so we try to be as authentic as possible.
Now, the hot new condiments or ingredients, you're going to help me now. It's holy gochujang.
Yes, gochujang. That's pretty good.
Okay, and you sent us some of that, and we've been slipping that into all kinds of dishes.
That's great.
And then we also have another one is doenjang.
Yeah, doenjang.
What's it called again?
Doenjang.
Doenjang. And then ganjang.
Yeah,
which
ganjang.
Is soy sauce.
Yes.
Which is spicier than Japanese soy sauce.
Oh, you find it spicier?
I don't know. No, it's not. You think not?
I wouldn't call it spicier per se, but it depends on the type of soy sauce. But the particular soy sauce, the holy ganjang we sent you, it's actually three-year aged. And it's made by our artisan. And it definitely has very complex taste compared to a lot of soy sauce you would find in the market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe that's what you mean. Like it has more flavors.
Right.
The thing that struck me about all the products is that there's a subtlety and a complexity that doesn't exist in, for example, Chinese Sichuan spices and Indian curries where what happens is the effect is to blast the top of your head off or to cause you to weep when you don't want to. And the subtlety of it was the thing I found the most surprising and very satisfying.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad to hear.
Now, we also got a bowl, a ceramic bowl.
Yeah, it's
tell me about that.
It's like a Korean earthenware.
Okay, yes. And tell me about it. Is it important? It's a basic utensil. In cooking utensil.
I think it is definitely a traditional cooking utensil, and a lot of Koreans use it for different things. It's mainly used for dish called bibimbap, which is, it's very popular Korean dish, actually. It has rice topped with a variety of vegetables and meat, very beautiful, and it's served in a big bowl. And the bowl itself is heated up, so when it's served, it's sizzling still. So when the whole time you're eating, you're actually enjoying this like hot sizzling food. And also, rice crust forms at the bottom, and that's actually another highlight of the dish. So there's a dish called bibimbap that you can use that with, and also for a lot of soups, we would use that because again, you can cook and serve with it. So while you're eating it. You know, actually food it, keep the food hot.
Okay.
And so there's different types of, I guess, cookware like that. So we do use sometimes ones that are made with natural stone. And this particular one I sent you is a ceramic. It's made with clay. And stone ones are great too, but this particular one is made with finer clay, and it's glazed with natural glaze. And it has finer pores, so it's actually more sanitary than, you know, the natural stone ones and other ones that might be in the market.
Uh-huh.
It breathes. The air goes in and out of the pores, but it doesn't absorb, like, dish water and things like that.
Uh-huh.
So,
but you could make any dish without using that, I mean.
Yeah, we have customers using our stone bowl for everything, like everything from cereal bowl to making casserole to making popcorn to rice. And so, yeah, they use it for everything. And what's really good about it is that you can use it in the oven, on the stove, broil, so you can use it. We do have not only the bowl, but sizzlers, like the sizzling plate.
Yes,
you can
I see
use it for like grilling fish and things like that. So yeah, people use it for everything.
Yeah, no, we have we know a man who became a friend of ours, who started. We watched him grow. He is from Korea, and mm-hmm. he opened a sushi restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, it's amazing how many Korean-run sushi restaurants there are as opposed to Japanese-run.
Yeah.
But anyhow, he started with one room, very small, and then he added a sushi bar room with four seats, and then he added a bigger one with, I think, 12 seats, and then he bought the building next door.
Wow.
Yeah, and then upstairs, he expanded upstairs, and he had he started adding Korean foods.
Mm, yeah.
And yes, and.
You know, he has a Korean barbecue.
Yeah.
Which apparently mm-hmm. is very, very, very like the Korean barbecues in Korea.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're very common in Korea.
Which one, the Korean barbecue restaurant?
Yes,
a Japanese restaurant.
I was talking about the Korean barbecue.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, Korean barbecue restaurants are very common. Usually they have these, like, table cooking tables,
he has
right?
That. Yeah.
And the really good ones have real charcoals. They use real charcoals in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, they would use gas. And, yeah, it's everywhere, and it's definitely Korean's favorite outing. And a lot of times, because, you know, meat obviously is expensive, so Korean barbecue would be like a special occasion thing.
Okay.
However, like, there are different types. Like, we have Korean pork barbecue, there's chicken, and even within that, there are so many variety of different spices. And, you know, the stuff you see here is only like very small part of Korean barbecue culture in Korea.
Yeah, there's one beef dish that start with a G or something like that.
Yeah, Kaibi.
Okay. And that's a highlight, I guess, of the Korean barbecue typically.
Yes, that's probably the most common and most loved one. Yeah, Kaibi is basically short ribs, but cut differently from short ribs here.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yeah, and it's seasoned with, it's soy sauce based sauce.
Uh-huh.
By the way, we are actually launching Korean barbecue sauces.
Oh, you are.
I'll send you some.
Oh, please.
Okay,
yeah. I love trying different barbecue sauces. I absolutely love it.
The other thing from his Korean menu that I noticed is, I don't remember what it's called, but all these little dishes of pickle kinds of that. What are they called?
You mean banchan? You mean like side dishes?
Yes. They're like pickles.
Pickles, oh yes. Well, you mean kimchi?
Well, he had more different kinds. He had kimchi, but he also had, I guess, other things.
Lots of different kinds.
Other things pickled as well, and you always had to have one of those and one of those and one of those.
Right. Yeah, we definitely have lots and lots of fermented and pickled vegetables. So even within kimchi, we have like, I don't know, if you really. We probably have like hundreds of different types of kimchi.
Yes.
Kimchi and fermented pickles, whatever. So, yeah, there's lots of side dishes.
So now, how big an inventory do you have on your website for these Korean ingredients?
Currently, how big of an inventory? I mean, we do have a lot of most Korean ingredients that's hard to find, you know, in regular markets, grocery markets. However, we are considering changing our direction a little bit to doing ingredient kits, like cooking kits instead.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, if you wanted to cook, I don't know, Korean barbecue, you would get the meat, the sauce, and all other vegetables you would need to do Korean barbecue.
That's a really good idea.
Great, thank you. Yeah, so we're moving towards more of a kit. But, we do have most of the major ingredients, and sometimes if we don't have it, people suggest it. If we can, we'll source it for them.
Okay, so people, if you want something special, you can actually write to Grace, email her, and ask for this.
We have a button called the Suggest a Product. So a lot of people request a product. I mean, obviously we can't always source a product for them for various reasons, but we try to. Or definitely we will take that into account when we're curating the new product and things like that. So, definitely.
On your literature, you emphasize that you have all these products that are gluten-free, vegan, chemical-free, probiotic, non-GMO for the soy sauce. So you're presenting a healthy side of Korean cooking. Is it all healthy like that?
Yes and no. I think in general Korean food is healthy. And it also depends on the dish. But one of the unique things about Korean cooking is we have a variety of, like, wide variety of ingredients we use and cooking methods we use. And like I said, the fermented sauces are like the basis of our seasoning. So I think it's pretty healthy. I mean, some people are a little bit concerned about sodium level, but that also depends on how much you put in and so on.
What?
Say that again, please.
Sodium, oh yeah.
Yeah, like salt, you know.
Yeah.
However, I think overall we have very healthy cuisine. However, if you buy Korean sauces or even, sad to say, in Korean restaurants, a lot of them will contain MSG or some sort of flavor enhancer. So what we thought was we to introduce like great authentic Korean food to people, and so we basically told ourselves, let's sell things, let's make things that we believe in available. So sometimes it's very hard because, you know, we're in North America and trying to introduce authentic food, but authentic but also good and healthy stuff. So sometimes we have to make them ourselves, or we will go meet artisans and ask For example, like our sauces we sent you, we searched for like a great artisan, and he was already making great stuff, but he didn't have any non-Korean audience, right? So we went to them, and you know, your stuff is amazing, and you're doing great work. We'd love to introduce your stuff to non-Koreans, but a lot of non-Koreans actually are looking for gluten-free sauces. So could you make gluten-free sauces with this type of ingredients, or you know, with certain, I don't know, restrictions, whatever. So, yeah, so we would do things like that, or we would just find small, medium companies or artisans in Korea that are making great stuff and trying to introduce to the global audience.
We almost debuted black garlic in the United States. The young men who were going to set out to market it, they were going to promote it as a health food. And I said, it was like the middle of the night, they were calling us from Korea. and I said, I mean, it was middle of the night there, not here.
Yeah.
So, but I said, you know, I think that you should go on flavor, and chefs are going to want to experiment with the flavors. And what, you know, I think you have a much bigger market with that than you do for health food. And of course, that's exactly what happened. They started giving it to chefs to play around with. And we had probably a 2-year supply of it.
Wow.
I didn't know what to do with it. There was so much of it.
You can pickle them.
We found another way out. We gave them away.
That's a good way too.
Yeah, we had a good round of giving away black garlic.
Does that taste different from regular garlic? I haven't tried black garlic.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it's totally different. It's fermented, number one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's totally different. Yeah, you haven't tried it?
Black garlic? I don't know. Are you talking about like it's pickled garlic?
Yes, exactly.
Pickled. Maybe I tried it. It's because it's in English. I'm not sure.
I see.
Yeah, it's pickled.
Yeah,
It's pickled and aged. I think that's the way it goes.
Right. I see. Okay. I thought it was like a species of different. You know what I mean? Like it's black color.
I think garlic,
it's a treatment. It's a treatment. So it's regular garlic. And apparently it was very much the kind of thing people did at home. And then these young men that Anne's referring to discovered a way of making it in volume in a factory environment
so that they
could produce a much larger amount and really get into the international food market. And I think they succeeded pretty well in doing that.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyhow, Grace, to our listeners, they should go first to your crazykoreancooking.com website and then go to your crazykoreanshopping.com and it'll be set up to create Korean dishes.
Sure.
All right. Well, we'll keep trying to figure this out. And thank you very much for talking to us. And let's see how we go with this Korean cooking trend. I think you're right on market here.
Thank you so much. Yeah, why don't you email me or give me a call if you have any questions along the way.
Okay, we will.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Grace. Bye.
Bye.
We've been in the mysterious East this week. Who knows where On the Menu will be next week. We hope wherever it is, you'll be there to join us. Same time, same place. And until then,
bye-bye.